Welcome to Pop Culture Retro, which was recently voted the 15th best podcast by the residents of the Golden Years Retirement Community in Boca Raton, Florida. Each show, we'll revisit some of your favorite pop culture memories with insider and outsider perspectives. Now, please help me welcome your hosts, Ike Eisenman and Jonathan Rosen.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Pop Culture Retro. Today, we are thrilled to welcome one of my favorite performers, a star of stage and screen and television, star of a couple of great Disney musicals, host of multiple television shows, including Hollywood Squares, guest host of The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, an incredible 87 times, and the owner and star of his own venue, Club Sandwich, located in Center Sandwich, New Hampshire. Please help us welcome John Davidson. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, hi guys. Hi Ike, hi Jonathan. Great to be on Pop Culture Retro. Yeah, I am retro. That's what I am.
So are we, hence the name of our show.
Yeah. But we've been looking forward to having you on for a long time. I mean, but you're one of those guests who you're like, where do we start? Your career has been so varied and extensive in all areas. So I guess we'll start at the beginning. You grew up in Pittsburgh to a religious family. Your parents were ministers. Did you always want to be a performer? And how did that conversation go when you said, hey, this is what I want to do?
No, I was a very shy kid. But growing up as a preacher's kid, you're exposed to a lot of people. So you learn to schmooze with anybody who comes into the house or whatever. So I got used to putting on that face of being the perfect preacher's son thing. And I'm really not religious at all. I'm an atheist, but I come from a very religious family. And I became a philosophy major at Denison University and graduated with a BA in theater arts because I went into theater arts originally so I could be a better preacher. And then I realized I really don't have, I don't have the religion. I just can't buy it. And my folks were very supportive of that. And
that's good.
Yeah. But growing up as a preacher's kid is a very theatrical way to grow up because you're constantly put on parade as being the epitome of what a fine young man should be. You
know? Well, what's the first thing you remember performing in?
Well, at Denison, I did a musical at the end of my sophomore year. And that's when I changed from my philosophy major to a theater arts major because I like theater arts people. And the study of theater, of course, is the study of human nature. And I like trying to figure out why we do what we do and what makes the whole thing work. My first show was a musical called Down in the Valley. Mm-hmm. And then I did some Shakespeare in college. And I played Little Abner in Little Abner. I did the Fantastics there for the first time, the off-Broadway musical that I later did on Hallmark Hall of Fame. So I did a lot of theater and then went to New York City and got started on Broadway in 63, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, so I mean, that's really how you got discovered was getting into Broadway.
Yeah. In the 60s, there was a question when you're a theater arts major, should you, if you want to be in theater and television, should you go to New York or LA? Well, LA was, that's where all the TV was. And back then that's where the film was, but I wanted to go to Broadway. And my first show was playing Curly in a, oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way. So I played Curly and got an award for it for a newcomer to Broadway. And that got me going. And then a television producer saw me in this show called Foxy. Well, Oklahoma, and then Foxy with Bert Lahr. I played the young juvenile lead in that, a romantic lead. And then this TV producer, Bob Banner, who discovered Carol Burnett on Broadway, was looking for a guy to develop as a variety show host. And so he developed me, and I signed a contract with him and he got me a Columbia Records contract, recording contract. And so Bob Banner really got me going as a total career, not just in Broadway. His idea was that be a Swiss Army knife, be a pitchfork, as opposed to just a spear. And he said, you got to do it all. And so he helped me do a Las Vegas act. So he fashioned kind of a broad career, jack of all trades, perhaps master of none. I mean, I never spent enough time recording in the recording studio. So I have no identity. I put out some records that got some play, but I never had a big record. So when people come to see me, when I'm singing as John Davidson, I can do anything I want. It's very free, but they have no idea what I'm going to do musically. So that's a lot of freedom.
You just mentioned that the Fantastics, that you were in the TV special, The Fantastics, who also had Ricardo Montalban on there. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about, how you got cast, and then what that experience was like all of a sudden, you know, working on this television program?
Yeah, that was one of my first TV shows. The Entertainers was the other one in 64, I guess. 64. And that was the Entertainers was with Carol Burnett and Bob Newhart and Dom DeLuise and just some great people. But the Fantastics, I played Matt, that's the juvenile lead. And Susan Watson was the young girl in that. She was also in Oklahoma with me in the Broadway revival. But Fantastics, of course. Try to remember the 9th of September when grass was green and rain was yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you were a tender and callow fellow. I certainly was a callow fellow, and I admired Ricardo Montalban sang that in the show as El Gallo, and of course I think that's probably the most well-known song from the Fantastics. And Ricardo Montalban was so cool. I just wanted to be like Ricardo Montalban, you know. But anyway, I was very square and very wholesome and very clean. I remember being very clean cut, and because of the conservative family that I came from, you know. And and then I began to meet theater people, and of course they broadened my outlook on life. When Bob Banner helped me put together my Las Vegas show, that I played the Elvis showroom at the Hilton, we always had a guitar segment where I would sing with my guitar. And that was my favorite segment in the show. So now, I mean, let's skip ahead here. I just turned 80. 80? 80? I just turned 80 last December. I asked somebody, do you think I look like 80? And she said, no, you used to, but not anymore.
Oh, that's a great line.
So, but now at 80, I have a little club in Sandwich, New Hampshire. And it's called, of course, Club Sandwich, which is kind of a corny name, but it's present fantastic. Other performers one night a week. I present other singer songwriters, and then I sing every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday matinees. And so I'm putting lots of new songs in for this season. We opened June the 24th. I wrote a new song. Spend one night with an old guy, and you never know. go back to the boy. Stand one day with an old guy. Let the little boys go play with their toys. I'm talking about a guy who can slow down. Turn your hot flashes into chills. You might need a break from his passion. You might need to hide his little pills. Don't you worry about your reputation. Now, he'll never tell how you drove him insane. No, he won't, because he can't remember the things that you did. No, he won't remember your name. Spend one night with an old guy, and you never go back to the boys. Just one more verse. You'll play Johnny Mathis on his 8-track. His lava lamp will glow all through the night. He'll whisper, you're the prettiest girl in the world. Of course, he's probably losing his sight. But who cares if it makes you feel special? Just don't let it go to your head. Because he's never going to invite you home to meet his parents. There's a pretty good chance they're dead.
Oh, my God.
And one night with an old guy. And you never go back to the boys. Big finish. You won't find the guy more grateful. I mean, it's not like they're beating down his door. And next morning, he'll have no job to dash off to. He can kind of stick around and fix that cracked window or that squeaky kitchen cabinet door or glue together that wobbly chair or anything else around the house that needs a little tender love and care. You'll have a dandy, randy, handyman. And ooh, you'll never go back to the boys. That's my new song. Yes.
That is fantastic. Oh my goodness.
We would ask about Club Sandwich after, but like, since you brought it up now, when you decide to start doing it, I've seen the pictures of the venue. It looks fantastic. Looks like such a fun place to watch a show in. So how did that come about?
Well, for the last couple of years, I've been touring. I've always done Broadway shows all through my career, but I was the wizard in Wicked, the Broadway musical Wicked. I played the wizard for 3 different contracts over a period of about a year. And then I played Captain Hook and another character, actually a dual role in Finding Neverland, the story about Peter Pan, how it was written by James Barry. And so I've been touring a lot. And I thought, I just want to stay where I had moved to New Hampshire to get back to my roots because I grew up in West Bridgewater, Massachusetts, long story. But I wanted to get back to New England, found an old barn, old farmhouse that had been redone. And so moved to Sandwich, New Hampshire, where this great house was. Met a lot of great people here. And I thought, I'm going to take this barn in center Sandwich and make it into a showroom. And I'm going to sing there. And I'm going to, my opening number is, well, I bet you're probably wondering what I'm going to do tonight. A fella has to holler when he's feeling all right. I finally busted out. I busted out. I was trapped in your TV. Now I'm gonna tell you what you're doing to me? You drive me crazy. You know, so that and through that, in that number, I kind of talk about being on Broadway in Vegas and how I've settled here in Sandwich. And I love singing with my guitar. To me, it's better than sex. Of course, most things are now, but you know, I just love singing with my guitar. So, and then I present other performers on Thursday night. If anybody wants to check that, they could go to johndavidson.com and there are tickets available. But my first two shows are sold out, actually. June 24th and 25th are sold out. See, it's a very small place. When I say I'm sold out, there's only like 40 seats and it's like singing in my living room. It's I love it. Yeah.
All right, we're going to post all the information as well, but I really urge everyone to go check out the pictures. It looks so fantastic. It looks like such a fun place to see a show, as I mentioned. It looks so cozy, actually. So we will. I did want to go back. I wanted to ask about you were a couple of the Disney musicals that you were in, you know, including Let's Start with Happiest Millionaire, which is one of my favorite Disney movies. I've watched it so many times, and it starred you, Leslie Ann Warren, Fred McMurray, Tommy Steele, songs by the Sherman Brothers. It was the last film that Disney was involved with. How did you get the role and what was Walt like?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, thanks, Jonathan, for remembering that. Yeah, this, the Disney people saw me on a Bell Telephone Hour, a show I did in New York, and I signed actually a 3-picture contract. It was my first movies. And as you say, the Sherman Brothers had written Mary Poppins, and they were trying to follow up with another period musical. It took place in 1912, Happiest Millionaire. The trouble is it didn't have the fantasy that Mary Poppins had. It didn't have any cartoons on the screen. And we didn't have Dick Van Dyke and I can't think of the wonderful lady's name who played Mary Poppins.
Julie Andrews.
Julie Andrews. Oh, yeah. But I fell in love with Leslie Ann Warren in the film. And in Happiest Millionaire, I sang, "Are we dancing? Are we really here? Is this feeling something real? Or will it disappear?" It was my big break in film, and you knew that Walt Disney was coming down to the set because everybody would say, "Walt is coming." Never Mr. Disney. Walt is coming. So everybody get kind of nervous, and he called me John. And at lunchtime, you'd see him at the commissary having lunch right there at another table. He was very visible. Hi, John. How you doing? Oh, fine, Walt. How you doing, Walt? I mean, oh my goodness, it was a fantasy to me, and I was 24, something like that. It was in 66. I was 25. So anyway, so it was a thrill, and Fred McMurray, Tommy Steele was in it. What a talent, a British rock and roller who grew up to do Broadway shows. And then that led to the one and only Genuine Originally Family Band, the second one. Those are both available in DVD. So a lot of young people know me from these films. In Family Band, I had the love duet was about time. We had a little taste of wasting time like lovers do. I'll waste a little time along with you. About time we two were living out a lovely dream come true about you, about me, love. Just looking into Leslie Ann Warren's eyes for the 4 months that we shot it, I had such a crush on her. We got along great, and so that was fun doing those two films with her. That was my introduction into doing films.
I was just going to ask about Walt. I didn't get to work for the studio until the mid-70s, so I never had the opportunity to meet him. You mentioned you visit the set, but was he very involved in the movie?
I didn't really know, quite honestly. Of course, each one of the films, I'm sure you know, Ike, that each film has its own producer, right? Yeah. So, and our producer was a man named Anderson. Can't think of his first name. But yeah, so he was involved with the Walt never... He never made any comments. He never said, oh, you better do that again. That could be better. He never tried to direct. He was very much a perfect CEO in that he hired great people around him to do it right. And I'm sure in those meetings that we never saw as actors, I'm sure he said, now, this is the way we do it here at Disney. And because everybody was very aware of what it meant to make a Disney film. And of course, The Happiest Millionaire was the last one he made before he died. And then Family Man, I was there for making the first musical when Walt wasn't there. So everybody was running around saying, what would Walt do? What would Walt do? What would Walt want this to be? And of course, you can't run a studio that way. You can't try to fit into his shoes. You got to buy your own shoes and wear your own shoes. That was an interesting time to be at Disney. But he was just always very supportive. And of course, he was smoking one cigarette, Walt Disney, one cigarette after another, just a chain smoker. And what a shame. But what a great man.
I don't know if you know anything about it, but I read that the Sherman brothers didn't want Fred McMurray in Happiest Millionaire, but Walt overruled it. Did you hear anything about that at the time?
No, not at all. Fred McMurray was just an interesting... He'd be sitting in his chair there waiting to go on, and I took a minute, went over and sat next to him, and I said, would you... Because at that time, I was hosting the Carson show. I was sitting in for Johnny Carson a lot. I said, would you ever do the Tonight Show with me? You know, I'd love to have you as a guest. And he said, oh, no... John, I'm not very comfortable with those kind of shows. He really wasn't. He was a very shy man. And he said, you know, I'm the least likely person to be in this business. He said, I was playing saxophone in a band, and somebody said, you know, you could be an actor. And he said, well, might as well try that. And just, he was just a very unassuming, humble guy, and who didn't like to talk about himself. And he probably would have been a terrible guest on The Tonight Show. I'm glad he said he didn't want to do it. But just a great guy. And yeah, okay.
Well, you just mentioned Tommy Steele a few minutes ago, and the number you have with him, Let's Have a Drink, is one of my favorites in any Disney film. I love that song. I watched that movie so many times. You still hear the song walking down Main Street in Disney. How much fun was that to film and working with Tommy Steele on that?
Jonathan, you're great, but you really should get out more. You know, I don't know. I'm sure you have a lot of other favorite things, but thanks for liking that. It was great. It was Tommy Steele's number all the way. He was just so magnetic, and I wanted to be like Tommy Steele. He just was a powerhouse, magnetic live performer. He then did Half a Sixpence on Broadway after that. Went to see him and went backstage, and we reminisced about that song. And a lot of stuntmen, it was a fight in a bar. And one of those in an Irish pub, just a really fun song. I think the song was perfect for him because he's kind of a song and dance man, and it was great working with him. It was full of stuntmen. There were just a lot of fists flying, and I learned how to throw a punch. I think, who did I knock down? I knocked out somebody. I don't know. But of course, I didn't really hit him. It was all fake. And then I wound up, I don't know. I, anyway, It was fun. The whole movie was great. We spent about 4 months doing it, which I guess is the normal time to make a musical film, and it was a pleasure.
Just curious, because the character you played, the Andre Duke, did not have a happy ending in real life. So did you ever get to meet the real Cordelia Biddle? Did she ever come down to watch anything or no?
We met somebody from one of the, it was about these famous families of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. The Dukes and the Biddles. Somebody did come to the set one day. I think it was a Biddle. I don't even know. I don't know. So many people came down to the set that I think I did meet people from the family, but I don't remember that much about mm-hmm. it.
Well, had you seen the play or read the book that the movie was based on?
No. What was it based on?
It was Cordelia Biddle had written her book about the family. And I think there was a Broadway play in the 50s about it that Walt got the idea to turn it into a musical after.
Yeah. I probably did in getting ready for the part. I just can't remember. I didn't, it was all so new to me there. And I was just, the whole time is just went by so fast. I was just meeting new things and doing new things every day.
So you'd mentioned Leslie Ann Warren. What was it like working with her?
Just a great lady, very honest with herself. She reminded me a little bit of Sally Field. I did a series later with Sally Field called The Girl with Something Extra, mm-hmm. where she had ESP and could read my mind, and I played her husband. That sort of honesty. I've never worked with people like Meryl Streep, but I bet working with Meryl Streep was this tremendous honesty and self-awareness. And Leslie Ann has that, just feet on the ground, and so does Sally Field, and just no pretension. I mean, you could just share anything with them. We were instant buddies and just very open people that were very honest. I think you find that in the most successful people, maybe this isn't true, but I've just met so many great people in show business that had this honesty about it. You, in order to play a role and to figure out, you have to figure out who you are so you can play another role. And so there's a lot of self-discovery and just getting honest with yourself. And those are my favorite people in show business, the people that are honest with themselves. And those ladies were.
Well, you just mentioned the show. We were going to ask you about that as well. The Girl with Something Extra with Sally Field. Also had Terry Garnett about, like you said, a woman who could read, your wife who could read minds, which seems like a terrible thing in real life.
Right.
But it looks like it catered to like the Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie audience. And it was right on after Sanford and Son. So it seems like so great. Why do you think that show didn't make it? What happened with that?
Yeah, it ran 1 year. So we did 26 episodes. But really, I think Girl with Something Extra was... of course, Sally was great, and she was in transition, as you just mentioned, from being the Flying Nun and Gidget and those things. She had so much more to offer, and I think she was finding that in The Girl with Something Extra. Then, of course, she went on to win all the couple of Academy Awards and, incredible performances. But she was in transition, and the show... couldn't decide, I think, whether it was going to be a romantic comedy or whether it was going to be romantic or be comedy. And it wasn't that funny. It was romantic, but then it tried to be funny. And I think it was a show that didn't quite find its way. So we had a great first year. I think, again, I had a crush on her all the way through the pilot and through making it, and I think as the season went on, we we lost that crush, and we got along, but it wasn't like when we first started, when we were really crazy about each other. So it was an interesting year, but we got to know each other really well, and we could read each other's minds sort of, and what how we were going to react. And she helped me a lot with acting. She's a wonderful actress or actor, however you want to say it. She was just such an inspiration to work with. Great, great lady.
Well, yeah, I mean, and as you mentioned, of course, her career went stratospheric, but a couple years after that, she just started exploding. Could you see that coming in her? Did you know that was going to be part of her future?
I thought I could. I had no idea that she would win awards and stuff, but she was digging deeper and deeper and was really getting in touch with deeper things than she ever could show before that in Flying Nun and Gidget, of course. And you could see that she had a lot more there that she was digging into, and it all worked. Yeah.
It was around that time, the same time the show came out, that you did your Cosmopolitan photo shoot where you were really naked. And then you also did the Streets of San Francisco guest appearance, both of which were like so against type for you. Were those decisions made to try to steer you into another lane? Like your manager said, like, I think you should do this.
Yeah. I had a manager, Alan Bernard, who tried to do things that would broaden my career and open up other possibilities than just playing boy meets girl and the biggest problem is pimples. And so we'd get into things. So Helen Gurley Brown was looking for a follow-up to Burt Reynolds in Cosmopolitan. Now, this wasn't naked. I wasn't naked in the Cosmos wearing a towel. They made me Mr. February, which of course is the shortest month. So it's funny. I did a centerfold in Cosmo, but I think a lot of people just felt, just what are you doing? I brought the picture back to Hollywood Squares at the time. I was guesting. Peter Marshall was the host, and I was guesting, sitting next to Paul Lynn. So Paul Lynn, Peter Marshall says to Peter, John did a centerfold for Cosmopolitan. And Paul made a funny face, got a big laugh. And then he said, well, he looks like he should have been the ambassador to underdeveloped countries. So it was funny. He didn't make up any of that stuff. All of Paul Lynn stuff was written, but it was very funny line. But yeah, it was kind of a stupid thing to do. So that's why we did the Cosmo Centerfold. I still get grandmas now that bring the centerfold up for me to sign. It's amazing. So I guess, I guess women, and guys, or and somebody was buying the magazine. At that same time, this role on the Streets of San Francisco, the part of a female impersonator who was a killer. It was a murder mystery, actually. I kill guys when I was the woman. I played a woman and a man, and did kind of a Carol Channing impression. I studied with a female impersonator for a month or at least 3 weeks. And what I discovered is that when I played the woman, first of all, when we were shooting, I was nervous about doing it. And so I was drinking lots of coffee and Tab, the diet drink Tab. And we were shooting in San Francisco, so when you're in San Francisco and you're in full drag and you have to go to the bathroom, which bathroom do you go to? So I walked into the ladies' room, figured that would be the quickest in the city. And I wasn't in there for 30 seconds. And a lady walked in and she said, what are you doing in here? And I said, how did you recognize me? She said, you were the only one standing. That was a joke. That was a joke. I'm trying to put in jokes. And anyway, but what I discovered is that women, to play a woman, women don't talk up here. I mean, only Julia Child. Julia Child's used to talk. Well, then you take the flower and you put the flower in the thing. But a woman just talks up here. It's up here. That's all it is. And not all men talk down here like, Ricardo Montalban. But the difference vocally between men and women is often, it's not that clear. And if you're a drag queen, then you exaggerate it, And also, not all women are that feminine, So there was a scene of me walking through the lobby of this hotel, the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco. And I was trying to walk like a woman. And the director said, no, you look like a drag queen. If you want to really be a woman, I forget what he told me, but he said, you can't overdo it because women don't walk that way. Some women walk like men, So I learned a lot about the difference between men and women.
That's probably a 7-volume book, set of books to do that. But yeah, what we got, you mentioned the Tonight Show, you were with Johnny Carson. Before they asked you to become a guest host, which you did an incredible 87 times. Just want to find, what was Johnny like a little bit, and how did they come to ask you to be the guest host so many times?
Well, it wasn't just he was very supportive of me. Johnny was just great to me, and I appreciate it. And Ed and Doc, but there's always another part of the story. That it started when I was doing The Girl with Something Extra with Sally Field on a network called NBC. So I think no one ever said this to me, but I think NBC went to Johnny and Fred DeCordova and Peter LaSalle, the producers, and said, we'd like you to use Davidson as a guest host because he's doing The Girl with Something Extra on NBC. And I swear that's how it started. But then I got along with everybody well and worked well with Fred DeCordova, who produces the show. And I don't know. I do it a week at a time. I always did Christmas week and usually another week during the show. And instead of doing jokes at the top of the show, I sang a couple of songs, and it was great. It was a great chance to showcase what I was doing, but you always had to realize that it's Johnny's show, and I would try to get friends on the show that they would say, no, we don't want them. I tried to get Kenny Rogers on the show, and they said no. And they said to me, Kenny Rogers is not a talker. And I said, are you kidding? Kenny Rogers tells incredibly funny stories, and he's a very clever guy. He was. He passed away, of course. But I was able to get Kenny Rogers finally to get him on the show. I think at that point, they just were not booking a lot of country acts. I don't know where that came from, Johnny or whatever. But I finally was able to get Kenny on, and he told a great story. It was very funny. And I wasn't able to do anything but to sit in Johnny's chair and play with a pencil that said Johnny on the pencil, and the coffee mug said Johnny on the coffee mug, and so it was very much not my seat, and you got to deal with that because why should it be? So, but it was a great experience. Yeah. And then after that, I got my own talk show. I replaced Mike Douglas for Westinghouse, a daytime talk show, for a couple of years. And that was great. I had a lot to learn about being a host. And Mike Douglas pointed that out.
Oh, dear.
So that Mike Douglas wasn't very nice to me about that. But I, But he was right in a way. I was an entertainer. I flew in from Las Vegas to host my own talk show. And I mean, really, I had a lot to learn, and I got better in the second year.
Well, how was your relationship with Johnny? Was that good?
Oh, excellent. Actually, just a great guy, very supportive. And Johnny Carson was a very shy man. And I mean, at a party, you would see him over talking to someone in the corner. He was never the life of the party. You know, he was a very shy. I don't know what creates that, but low self-esteem. I don't know. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I don't think that Ed McMahon knew Johnny Carson that well. I don't think that Doc Severinsen knew him that well. And I didn't know him that well either, but he was always so supportive of me and just great. Just a real gentleman, real gentleman. Yeah.
Well, you had mentioned something that's interesting. That just, you know, you said to you when you were guesting that they didn't let you have certain guests that you wanted. Did they also not let you have other guests that they said, oh, no, no, we're saving them for when Johnny comes back?
I didn't get that feeling. No, I didn't. That might have been true, and maybe they were booked for the next week or the following month or something, because Johnny was going to be there. I think a lot of guests would rather not do the Tonight Show with a guest host. You know, you'd rather do it with Johnny. I'm sure the ratings were better with Johnny than any guest host. So, they never let me know that. I didn't know. Mm-hmm.
Well, you've already mentioned the Hollywood Squares, which we want to bring up, which you were a regular on, and you ended up hosting, and it's still considered one of the best game shows of all time. And the fact that Paul Lynde's jokes were written, was that true of everyone?
Yeah, everyone was given a funny answer. Of course, they can't give you the question, and they can't give you the real answer because there are laws against that, you know.
Yeah.
So, but they gave you a joke and you didn't know what the setup was.
Okay, that's fascinating.
Yeah, so that was the brilliance of Paul Lynde, that he was able to step in and do a punchline and he never even knew what the setup was. You know, all he knew was that the line was point and giggle. And you didn't know that the setup was that what is one thing you should never do in the bedroom? Point and giggle, you know.
Yeah.
So sure. It's a cute joke, but he didn't know what the setup was. But you know, usually when I was guesting on Hollywood Squares with Peter Marshall, who of course Peter Marshall was the award-winning host. By the way, Peter Marshall's like 96 now and doing great. He was the first host. I was the second host. And then, of course, Tom Bergeron was the third host with Whoopi Goldberg in the center square. My center square was Joan Rivers, and who was great. And what I loved about Squares, so my agent came to me and he said, I've got that series that you've always wanted. Finally, I've got that series. I said, what is it? He said, well, we have an offer. I said, is it the $6 million man? Am I going to be like an action hero? And they said, no, it's a game show. And I honestly turned it down at first. And I went to a friend of mine, a lawyer named Lane Dicker. And I said, I want to act. I want to sing. He said, are you crazy? This is Hollywood. This is a huge show. You got to do this. So I took the show, and I loved meeting all the famous people and hearing about all their projects. Hollywood Squares, like Jeopardy or Wheel of Fortune or all these daytime shows, are done. You do the whole week in one day. So you have dinner between Wednesday and Thursday while they change the audience, because you wear out the audience on the first three shows. So at this dinner between Wednesday and Thursday, you it's a buffet, And you get to meet all these famous people and spend that dinner with them. And it was just a great way to meet a lot of people in the business. So I love that. And I loved hosting Squares. It was great.
You had just mentioned Paul Lynn, and I was like everyone else at the time. I was such a huge fan. I loved all the jokes and everything. He was so funny to me. The last couple of years, I've read so many negative things, how dark he was and such a bit. How did you find him to be like, well, because things I've read are not nice. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think he liked me or Karen Valentine. I think he thought that we were both just too clean, too goody-goody, too square. I don't think Paul Lynn liked himself. And I got the feeling that he didn't like me. And it was just negative and gave me dirty looks. And I don't know. I think he just wasn't happy. I think he was not a happy man. And I think that's true of a lot of people who are funny. They're not the happy people. I don't know why that goes hand in hand. Not all the time, but sometimes.
I think you're right. I think I've read a lot of the same type of things, that a lot of the best comedians have all these dark sides.
Yeah. I think, humor can be darkly funny. You got to look at the dark side of things. If everything is just rosy, then maybe it's not funny, you know. But of course, Norm Crosby, I worked a lot with Norm Crosby, and he seemed to be a very happy guy. But I worked a lot with Jerry Van Dyke, Dick Van Dyke's brother, very funny in his act. And I'm not sure he was that happy a person. He was drinking a lot. It takes all kinds, but somehow depression and humor tend to go together, I think.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned drinking. We had Anson Williams on, and he said that Hollywood Squares, like the Thursday and Friday shows, were the ones to look out for, because like what have you just said, because everyone started, they taped the weeks and everyone's drinking at lunch. So did you find that to be the case the same way?
Yeah, everybody usually has a glass of wine and a beer or two. And yeah, so always watch the Thursday and Friday shows. nobody's drunk, but they're certainly a little more easygoing.
Well, when you hosted, were there any celebrities who were like less than stellar, kind of duds with their answers, or not what you expected when they appeared?
Yeah, some celebrities never deal with playing themselves. And so they're actors on series. So they've never worked on, well, when I'm me, what role is, who am I? I've worked a lot on that, trying to figure out who John Davidson is, so that, I'm not just a character in a Broadway show or in a sitcom, or I'm me. And so I've spent a lot of time getting comfortable in my own skin. And a lot of, some actors are not. So those actors don't do the jokes well and are not comfortable being themselves. So people, of course, on the shows like that, you always wanted to get Betty White. If you could get Betty White on it. And we had Alf on my show, Alf, the guy who did Alf, the puppet Alf, very clever guy. And we had a lot of, right, Jim J. Bullock was outrageously funny. And there's just a lot of very talented people. But the classic, going back to Peter Marshall's Hollywood Squares with Wally Cox and Charlie Weaver and Rose Marie and, of course, Paul Lynn and George Gobel. Oh, my goodness. These are just classic clowns. Yeah.
Wanted to ask about some of your memories of That's Incredible, which you did with Kathy Lee Crosby and Fran Tarkenton.
Uh, that was probably my biggest show. It was 5 years on ABC. It was like a Ripley's Believe It or Not, you know, showing people going the extra mile or going the distance mentally and physically and different just oddities of life. It was just a fascinating show. Very young following. So a lot of kids who were like 12 to 15 are now, early 40s. And so that audience remembers me as that. But those people don't know that I sing. Some people who come to see me still don't know that I sing. No. But in Hollywood Squares, and that's incredible, I didn't sing at all. So it's a surprise when I start singing, you know, on other shows. Because they missed the variety show years of my career, which were in the 70s, really 70s and early 80s. That's incredible. I was very proud of it and loved working with Fran Tarkenton. He's also a preacher's son. So when preacher's son get together, they try to say as many four-letter words as they can. Tried just to be as nasty and dirty and just to show that we're not goody-goody, you know. So we would always be telling each other just the foulest, dirty jokes. And Kathy Lee was great and so lovely, and she was great too. So, I was not pleased. I had some arguments with but I would say, why are we doing these stories about ghosts and about ESP and about things? And at the end, we'd say, what do you think? You know, and you know, there are no ghosts. Come on. I mean, there's no such, a ghost is human imagination. And I wish that we had said that and not leave it open for people to be fooled by people who are selling ghost stories and stuff. So, yeah, but it was a great show.
Was there anything presented to you that you just said, no, we can't do that on TV?
Well, you got to remember that Fran and Kathy Lee and I had nothing to do with producing the show. We were simply dressing. We came in on show day, and the staff and I've forgotten the producer's name. Artie Forrest was the director for a while, and Woody is what was the producer. They would decide on what stories were good, and we were just dressing. We made no decisions about the show at all.
I do need to ask about one show that you were on, which I loved. It was a huge pop culture show for my generation. Can't miss viewing in my house. You were on several Battle of the Network Stars and did well in the events. I watched some this past week, and the ones that you won, you did great in the swimming and the running. So we had on, and you captained the very last one and won. Actually, so that was the very last Battle of the Network Stars. Yeah. We had Hal Linden on. He said that everyone took it lightly until the competition started. So what are your memories of that show? And do you find that to be the case as well?
Yeah, I pulled my thigh muscle running because in a mile relay thing, because I ran full out without warming up, and I wasn't ready for it. And by that time I was, early 40s, I guess. But that's where I met Tom Selleck. Tom Selleck was this young buck, you know, looking great. And he did the Hawaiian show, the Hawaii 5-0.
Magnum P.I.
Yeah. Hawaii 5-0 was Jack Lord, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Magnum P.I. And great looking guy. He was so cool. I wanted to be like Tom Selleck. I thought, this is a cool guy. He's a ladies' man. He's a man's man. He's just a good guy. So that was fun meeting him. And it was fun meeting celebrities in a different situation, you know, and running around and trying to win. I don't know. It was a fun day. Yeah.
Well, you were in Edward Scissorhands. and with, of course, someone who's in the news now, Johnny Depp, and directed by Tim Burton. And that's one of my favorite movies. I think it's just an incredibly beautiful film. What was it like to work with both of them?
Well, the director, I'm trying to think of the director's, the great director's name.
Tim Burton.
Oh, Tim Burton, yeah.
Yeah.
So I only worked on that film for one day.
Oh, wow.
I just played a talk show host and worked with Diane Wiest, who's just wonderful, and met Johnny Depp in makeup, and he was trying to learn his lines and was busy, but I didn't really get to know him well. But Tim Burton spent about 20 minutes describing what Edward Scissorhands was all about, and was, I mean, his mouth couldn't keep up with his brain. He's just a passionate man who's overflowing with imagination, and very impressed with him. He literally couldn't speak fast enough to keep up with his brain. Just a brilliant guy. But I was only there for one day, so it was it was great. It's a wonderful film, but I just bopped in, grabbed the money, and ran.
My so favorite kinds of jobs.
Yeah. So you've starred with so many legendary performers through the years, like Lucille Ball, Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Jerry Lewis. Anyone really stand out to you that this person was great, or someone that you thought was intimidating, or not what you thought that they would be?
I did two of the Lucille Ball shows later, when Lucy Arnaz, her daughter, played her daughter on the show, right? And I was the love interest. So Lucy and I had fun. We did a couple duets together. It was great. But I never realized that Lucy was so hands-on with that show. Now, I'm not sure she was in the original I Love Lucy show, but here she, you know, she was a showgirl, I guess, just a pretty girl that got into comedy. But man, she, by the time she got to the latter part of her career, especially, she knew lighting, she knew wardrobe, she knew direction. Oh, she knew just pacing of the show, camera angles, sound, whether the sound was right, and she was all over the show. And everyone on set knew that Lucy ran that show. So I saw a different side. She wasn't just a funny lady. She was brilliant at producing. She produced and directed, I swear. Bob Hope was very nice to me. We did a couple of his specials, and just a really sweet man. And so funny, because everything was on cue cards. So you would look, you'd be talking with him, and you'd be looking off camera. You couldn't look him in the eye because you're reading the cue card, and he wasn't looking at me. He was looking over my shoulder at the cue card while we're doing jokes. It was weird, but really a sweet man. It was a joy to work with some of those great. Carol Burnett helped me so much in the early part of my career, especially, and then she had me on her show a couple times, and it was just so supportive. And there's another case of a lady who's very shy, and just so warm, and she's figured out how to work with that. I think she was very shy as a kid, as I was, and I think she would rather play, you know, a goofy lady like a washerwoman or a proud grande dame than play Carol Burnett, you know. So she did several of films, I think, where she seemed more like doing Carol Burnett. And I think she would rather play a character. I think she would admit that. And so that's why she did the Q&A thing on her show. You know, her producer was Bob Banner, who found me on Broadway. And they said they developed that talk segment for Carol in order for her to have experience being herself, because I don't think at when she first did that, I don't think she trusted that she's a charming, lovable, funny lady. But I think she felt better when she was being goofy. And So it's interesting how everybody makes it through show business in different ways.
Yeah, I have to say I share that characteristic with you guys, because I was always a very introverted, shy child. And the fact that I actually got into the business at 9 years old and worked as much as I did fascinated me, because I was very reserved. But if you hand me my lines, my scene, my character, whatever I needed to do, suddenly then I came out. And so that was my place to be myself, was actually when I wasn't being myself. So I get it. It's a very strange thing, because there are those precocious people who are born performers. They're out front and center and they got no problem with it. And I admire them tremendously, because I do not have that in me at all. But moving on to just another fascinating thing about you, you created a game called Borderline USA. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Oh, thanks. I don't have a copy of it here. It's a geography card game. My wife and I, Rhonda, we homeschooled our daughter from second grade through eighth grade, and got her ready for a very fine private school in New Jersey. But she was homeschooled for about 6 years, and we did lots of games to teach her stuff. Borderline USA teaches people where the states are. It's all about where the states are. It's a little bit like Uno, the simple card game, but instead of playing a card that matches a color or a number in Borderline USA, you're matching borders. So you can play any state on top of the card played. You can play any state that borders the previous card. So if somebody played Texas, you could play Oklahoma on top of Texas. And there's four water cards: Great Lakes, one card, Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, Gulf of Mexico. So any state that bordered those areas can be, you know, it's all about what borders what. And there's a wild card to get you out of trouble. But the most fun of it is you can bluff. You can bluff if you say, I'm playing Maine on Arizona. And if nobody challenges it, you get away. So it's fun for the whole family. It's available on johndavidson.com. It's called Borderline USA.
Wow. Oh, that's amazing.
Sounds great. I want to get back to Club Sandwich before we let you go. Now, when does the new season start?
Friday, June the 24th, and we go through October 2nd. It's about 4 months. Mm-hmm. And then in the winter, I'm living on my boat in the Sea of Cortez near La Paz, Mexico. That's where my son is and my granddaughters. So this is our second season. And then we're presenting guest artists on Thursday nights. We've got a bunch of guest artists that you would know the names. I should have that list in front of me, but a bunch of very funny people. Very good songwriters. Yeah.
Okay. I wish I lived in New Hampshire. And if I got to make it over there to see you, because you're not coming to Florida to perform. So I got to get over there. Yeah. But John, this has been so much. I wanted to ask you again, do you have any social media that we should post besides johndavidson.com?
That's social media is what I'm. There's a Twitter account, Instagram, but I'm on Facebook a lot, and I love social media. It's helped me spread the word about Club Sandwich, and then I do a newsletter. I have a thousands of people that get my newsletter, and it's I love that. I'm trying to think of one last song I could sing you as we say hi.
I was hoping we were going to get an exit song.
Yeah, well, I want to say thank you to I want to say thank you to Jonathan. Pop Culture Retro. It's been a pleasure being on the show. I hope they'll invite me back. Got lots more to tell. Such a great show. Ike and Jonathan, Pop Culture Retro. I'm coming back.
Oh man, that's fantastic.
You're just so supportive, and thank you for letting me do it. Great talking with you guys. Good luck with the show, and congratulations on all your success.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure getting to talk to you. Huge fan always, and continue to be. So thank you.
Talk to you soon.
This has been Pop Culture Retro. I'm Jonathan Rosen with Ike Eisenman, and a very special thanks to John Davidson.
Thanks for watching, and please subscribe.
Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Retro, where no one was hurt during the making of this podcast.